The Google Podcast app is going away in April. Right now, I want you to take a look at the podcast app you're using right now. Maybe it's time for a new one. Check out podcastapps.com and try a new one for free right now. That's podcastapps.com.
Hi, friends. It's Carrie Dahl. Thank you so much for venturing into the inner circle with me. If you subscribe to my podcast and have been listening for a while, thank you. I appreciate you. If you're new, welcome to my circle, where the power of story is honored and I believe all voices need and deserve to be heard. As a former news anchor turned podcast host and public speaking coach, I know that stories are the most powerful way we connect as human beings. I feel privileged so many of you trust me with your stories, whether in my private Inner Circle Facebook group or right here on my podcast. Your story is your gift. Thank you for allowing me to share it with the world. My guest today will tell you that she owes her life to STARS. STARS, Air Ambulance, that is. And by saying those very words, you know this conversation is going to be intense. If I could sum up Michelle Salt's story in one sentence, it would be this. She never gave up, no matter what. She's a small town girl, and she had massive dreams with a massive passion for sports. She loved snowboarding and wanted to be a professional at it. She loves wake surfing and trying new tricks fuels her. She loves snowmobiling and dirt biking. She loves to try it all. But trying it all took on new meaning a number of years ago. It was June of 2011. She was out for an evening ride on her motorcycle, lost control, and crashed. Upon impact, she broke several bones and then severed her femoral artery, causing her to almost bleed to death. But remember how I said she never gave up, no matter what? Well, it held true in this situation too. Not only did she survive that horrible crash, but she went on to do this. She was the first female to compete in the debut of para snowboarding in the 2014 Sochi Paralympic Games. Yes, she is a two-time Paralympian. She's also a 13-time World Cup medalist in snowboarding and a three-time national champion. She is a two-time national champion silver medalist in adaptive wake surfing and helped pioneer the official sport of adaptive wake surfing in 2018. She was the most marketed Canadian Paralympian. I mean, her face, her image, her voice was everywhere. This is a story you need to hear. But her story has changed a lot in the last few years after she just missed the podium in the 2018 Games. So what happened? How did it impact and change her life? And it did in a big way. And she's going to go there today with her struggles and her challenges as of late and how she's coping. I am so honored that the one and only Michelle Salt is stepping into the inner circle today, joining me from beautiful Calgary, Alberta. What an honor it is to have this conversation with you.
And thank you so much for having me. It's great.
Honestly, Michelle, I read that and my jaw is on the floor of everything that you have accomplished in light of so many challenges. But when you hear that, do you ever have to pinch yourself and go, wow, like I really did all that after a horrible accident?
Yeah, for sure. I have my moments. I think more so now that I'm retired and I still bring it up once in a while. But in the moment, it was hard to see what I was accomplishing because it was just life. That was my everyday thing.
Let's go back to your upbringing. Small town of Alberta. Was it Calmar where you're born and raised?
Yep, Calmar.
Okay, so where did this love of sports and trying new tricks and snowmobiling and motorcycling all come from?
So I think the motorsports definitely came from growing up on a farm, and we always had little 80 dirt bikes and quads and stuff. And sports for me was my way of making friends. I was a bit awkward as a child, and I didn't really excel in school. but you put me on, you know, the baseball field or in Taekwondo or whatever it was that our small town offered. And I was a completely different kid. It was where I found my way to use my voice and my talents to be, you know, good at something.
How comfortable were you on that motorcycle?
Maybe a little too comfortable because, you know, it wasn't very long before I was going faster than I should have been. And I hit that guardrail. So I think in some ways, because of my history with motorsports, I had this false confidence and I was trying to keep up with the boys that day, thinking I had the skill set for that. And I clearly didn't.
Okay. Take us back to that night and what happened. What do you remember?
Well, I remember I was with my friend Gary and his friend Megan. We went out to Brad Creek, and at the time we were going, I'm not even going to tell you because it's a very illegal speed out to Brad Creek. And, you know, I needed to keep up. I didn't want to be left behind. And I remember getting to Brad Creek and saying, guys, like, we need to slow down because we're going to lose our license. And so we picked up another guy, Tanner and Bragg. We headed out to Cochrane. Megan went her own way. And then we get to the bottom of the hill. And the whole time from Cochrane or Bragg Creek to Cochrane, we're going the speed limit. For whatever reason, at the bottom of the hill, the guys open up and I try and, you know, keep up in the first corner. I don't really remember, but I must have hit my back brake, which caused this 500-pound machine to, me to be pinned between the motorcycle and the pavement. I went across a lane and a half, head first into the guardrail, did cartwheels in the air, and landed on the guardrail again. So obviously, Stars picked me up. I had broke several bones. I had compound tib fib, you know, pelvis, hips, L4, L5, right clavicle, punctured lung, bruised my spleen. And I was bleeding out. And where I had broke my femur in those two places, it made it really hard to tourniquet. So the people that had stopped, the medics, Stars, they couldn't do anything to stop the blood flow. So they had to let me bleed out. And for whatever reason, you know, someone was with me that day and my heart was strong because I bled out 23 minutes. Extremely rare. Yeah.
It's a miracle that you survived that.
It is. Yeah.
And you told me, did you have like an out-of-body experience during this?
Yeah. So the third time I lost my vitals, when they were transporting me from the medic stretcher to the Star stretcher, I had this full out-of-body experience. I was looking down at myself and my torso was a different direction than my lower body. And I remember thinking, I'm too young to die. This can't be it. You know, I need to fight for my life. And so I gave the medics my mom's phone number, which I was in shock at that point.
And you actually woke up and you spoke?
Yeah. So I guess this is what the medics told me. I don't remember really anything. So yeah, I gave them my mom's phone number. My mom was called. My dad was a firefighter for 35 years. He just happened to be home. And my parents were told, your daughter was in a serious accident. You need to get on the road now and come from Edmonton to Calgary because it's not looking good.
Okay. How old were you at the time?
I was 26.
26. Yeah. I mean, how much of living life had you done to that point? We're going to pause this accident. We're coming back to it. But like, where were you at in life?
I had thought I was in a good place. I had just finished my first fitness competition. I placed in the top five. So I was going to go for my pro card.
Okay. Hold on, because we didn't talk about that. You competed in competitions where, now was this bodybuilding or what, when you say fitness competitions?
Yeah. So the fitness competitions were in, I think I did fitness model. So I still trained for 16 weeks. I was in the best shape of my life. You know, I competed. I did well. I was like, this is it. I'm going to be on the cover of Oxygen magazine. Like I'm ready. I'm ready to be a fitness model. I had a wonderful job. I was the top sales rep for 6 months in a row. You know, I had my real estate license, which I was doing on the side. And so I thought that I was in a good place. But looking back at it now, like I was still struggling with my confidence. I was figuring out, you know, at 26, it's kind of the age where you're figuring out what does life look like. You know, I was ready to travel and buy a house and do all these things.
And anyone special in your life at that point?
Nope, I was
single. It was you living life to the fullest, like literally the fullest.
Yeah.
Okay, back to the accident we go. What did Stars tell you about, like, who found you? And how did they move you? What did they do?
Yeah, so I didn't really know much about my accident until I had transferred out of the foothills after a month and a half into Care West, which is a long-term rehabilitation center where I was for 3.5 months. And I got a call one day from the Cochrane, I think it was maybe the RCMP or the Alberta Health Services. And they said, we have a lady that laid on the ground with you and she wants to talk to you. And so I actually had a friend drive me out to Cochrane and I met her and her husband. And it turns out she was an emergency nurse before she had kids.
No.
And she knew her and her husband had stopped and there was a gentleman, they were coming up the hill and there was a gentleman coming down and all three of them had got out and they held hands and they said the Lord's Prayer as one of them put a jacket over my leg because they knew that like I was, it was like a garden hose, opening a garden hose when you sever that artery. And so they even said, we knew you were going to bleed to death. And so Glenn Ellen, this wonderful lady, she laid on the ground with me and she held my hand and she said, it's okay. You can go be with God. And she said, I didn't know if you were male or female. All I heard was just moaning. And I knew you were going to, I knew you were going to bleed to death. And there was nothing we could do about it. I couldn't pinch that artery. I couldn't tourniquet. So I did what I could to comfort you in that moment.
Michelle, she was your angel.
Yeah.
I mean, so at that point, were you at the back of the pack with your friends? Did they probably didn't even know this happened.
Nope. They were gone for probably about 10 minutes before they came back.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
And their shock upon finding you.
Yeah. So Tanner just met me and, you know, he was very upset. And then Gary obviously took over laying on the ground with me and telling me it was going to be okay. And nobody moved me because obviously she knew that I might have a spinal cord injury. So they just allowed, I guess I was trying to take my helmet off. Pretty stubborn, you know, like my shoe was, like yards away from where the accident was. That had come off. And there was, unfortunately, there was pieces of my leg on the guardrail. You know, the RCMP officer that had been an officer for 20 years told me it was the worst accident he's ever seen where someone survived.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So
did you sever your leg on impact?
Pretty much.
Is it your right leg?
Yeah. Yeah. Quite high above the knee.
Oh boy. Okay. Stars rushes you to the hospital. You talked about when you were out, but take us to the point when you woke up and you came to and you were received the news of what your new reality was and looked like.
So I was in a induced coma. You know, I hit a guardrail going 120 head first. So my brain needed to recover and, you know, the swelling needed to go down. Yeah. So I was in and out of this induced coma. And I remember day 4 waking up and I had full respirators in because I had punctured a lung and I was trying to rip them out. And it is a very traumatizing feeling waking up and not being able to breathe on your own when you're naturally trying to fight that feeling. And so my family had this board with a piece of paper on it and I would write because I wasn't able to sit up or anything like that. I would write, or at least I thought I was writing, you know, like choking and things like that, because mm-hmm. I was really struggling and boss and job and love and all of these things. Right. So finally my breathing tubes come out day 7 and the bone doctor comes in, or at least my ER doctor comes in and he's telling me about his neighbor and how he drives and he goes to university. And I'm like, he's telling me this story, how his neighbor drives and he goes to university. He's missing 2 legs. Wow. I'm like, okay, like, why are you telling me this story? So it was my older sister who broke the news to me. And originally she said, they amputated 2 inches above the knee. I'm about 10 inches above the knee. And I cried and it took some time. It didn't take long though for me to realize I had an opportunity. And I think it was even one of my siblings that said, well, you can go to the Paralympics now. It's like, yeah, I'm going to go to the Paralympics. And it was within the day, I'm like, I'm going to the Paralympics. That's it. And everyone's like, okay, you're heavily medicated, so we're going to come back to this. And I was like, no, like this is it. I'm going to be a Paralympian. I'm going to be a one-legged fitness model. And so I just went about my way.
That is so, where does that mindset come from? Because for so many people, it would be so easy to go into the mode of, oh my God, what just happened to me? What's happened to my life? Everything's been taken away from me. You went the exact opposite direction.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong. I had those moments and I still do sometimes. It is hard being an amputee, but I knew deep down I had to set a goal that would get me through these hard days and these dark moments. And so that was it. Everything that I did revolved around me being a Paralympian, my purpose of getting out of bed and going to rehab. And, you know, I still had days where it was a struggle, but for the most part, in order to achieve this big goal, I had to do my absolute best. And so I reminded myself of that.
Okay. So before we move into that phase of your story, I need to ask you, and I'm watching you as you're telling your story. I mean, you're also a speaker probably across North America and beyond. You talk to a lot of groups. I can't imagine how many times you've told this story. Does it ever get any easier?
Yeah. I find that when I tell my story, it's very healing for me. You know, I started talking 5 months after my accident and, you know, for Canadian Blood Services and for STARS. And that allowed me to sometimes cry, but also to relive it in a healing, as a healing mechanism, right? And it definitely gets easier for sure. But, you know, we will get into that. But what's happened in the last few years has brought the emotion back into the storytelling. So it has its moments.
And we'll go there a little bit later. Before we do, you talk about STARS. I can feel the gratitude when you talk about them. As you said, they saved your life. Did you reconnect with them? Is there a story there you can share?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've spent a lot of time with Pat Jeffrey, Ken King, who were my STARS medic and nurse, my pilots. I have done, I'd say 30, 40 speaking engagements for STARS. You know, I've been out to the Saskatchewan base and all these different places. And anytime that I'm close to the base or I have the chance, you know, 1 year they even asked me to call winners for the STARS lottery, which was really cool. Wow. So my story isn't necessarily old anymore, but they have all of these like amazing VIP stories to tell. Yeah. But for the first 2 years, it was anything I could do for STARS to ensure people understood the need to have that helicopter in the sky and the lives that it saved, or even that fighting chance that it gave people, I would do. Because I just think that, well, I know that if it wasn't for STARS, I wouldn't be here today.
What did they tell you about upon receiving you and flying you in?
So they were fueling when they got the call. If you listen to my STARS video, because there's a VIP video online, they actually used my dispatch call. And in the call, you have Ken King on there, who was the medic. And he says, you know, we have a 26-year-old female who wiped out on a motorcycle. She has a bilateral compound tib fib and an open and angulated right femur. She's quite an orthopedic catastrophe. We'll need a full trauma call out. And you can tell that I've watched that video a lot, but I was in really rough shape. And they knew that all I could do is bleed. At the time, they didn't have blood on the helicopter. So they said, we let you bleed out, and there was blood everywhere. And we just did what we could to comfort you and to talk to you. And the second we pushed you through the hospital doors, that's when your body shut down.
It shut down.
Yeah.
And like you flatlined.
Well, I don't know if I necessarily like, I haven't really asked about that, to be honest, because I think part of me, it's a
lot
for me. Well, it's a lot for me to hear that, but I think that's when you know, I had lost the amount of blood that is needed for your body to shut down. And that's when they hooked up this machine that rapidly pumps blood into you. And by the time my older sister, who was the closest relative I had, the location wise, got there, they were like, well, you know, she's going right into surgery and it's not looking good because she's lost a lot of blood.
Wow. And it was that moment you said when you shut down, that's when the out-of-body experience happened, right?
So it actually happened when I was being transported to the star stretcher on the hill still.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm really curious. At some point, I'd like to look into, I think I'm ready after 10 years, look into like what Ken meant by that.
Yes. I'm sure there's many people listening to this right now going, I know what it means. You need to do some research because I'm fascinated with things like that as well. And I'm sure, like you said, it was not your time. You had to, you're not giving up yet, that motto of your life, right?
Yeah.
So take us post-accident, rehabilitation begins and you have your sights set on the Paralympics. So that is snowboarding in the Paralympics, right?
Yeah, but interesting enough, at the time of my accident, snowboarding wasn't in the Paralympics in Sochi. And I just happened to get very lucky and they added it in 2012 as a late addition to the games. So, you know, there are people around me being realistic saying, Michelle, it's probably not going to happen for a while. Like even Greg Westlake, the captain of the para ice hockey team, came to see me in the hospital and he's like, go on the site, pick out some sports. And I was like, well, I want to snowboard. And he's like, well, if that happens, like it takes you a while to get the skills developed to be a high performance athlete and to make the national team to get to the games. So like set your sights on 2018. But I worked really hard. I tried out for the national team. They said, we know you have the heart. You don't have the skills yet, but we'll work with you to develop that. And I did. I pushed myself every chance I got. It took me 2 hours to get down one run at Lake Louise at the beginning. And then it was down to an hour and half an hour and eventually got better and better. And even when I went to 2014, I wasn't great by any means. But I was hungry and I was just fulfilling my bedside dream of becoming a Paralympian. That was it.
You said something at the beginning of that answer that he came to visit you in the hospital. So like you weren't joking when you said after waking up a few days later, you're like, yeah, I'm going to the Paralympics. Did you already like contact Team Canada and say, yeah, I want in?
I did. It was so funny.
Gosh.
So I was still in the foothills. I was in the trauma ward and I called Candace, the national coach. And I was like, hey, I want to be on your team. What does that look like? And she's like, okay, well, and I had contacted the cycling coach, Stephen Burke too. And he's like, okay, well, like, they're both like, where are you at? I'm like, well, so I'm still like, I'm just fresh out of ICU. I'm still in trauma. And it's going to take a while. I'm non-weight bearing for probably 3 to 4 months, but
yourself 3 to 4 months. Well,
well, I knew the doctors was like, it's going to take at least 3 months before you can even put any weight on your good leg.
Like I was thinking I was being like tongue in cheek, like maybe 3 to 4 years for most people. I mean, come on.
Oh yeah. So she's like, okay, well, why don't you just give me a call back in maybe like 6 months or after you've got on a snowboard? So that's how that first conversation went. I kind of jumped the gun on that one, but it's a funny story to tell.
It's incredible. Like there are so many different elements to your story that my jaw just keeps dropping. Here, I thought you gave yourself some grace to heal. No, no. We're ready to go right from the hospital, fresh out of ICU. Okay. When you talked about doing that first run at Lake Louise, what were the biggest challenges that you faced learning how to snowboard with your new leg?
Mm-hmm. So I had multiple doctors. Obviously, I had a neurologist and a trauma surgeon, many different doctors that essentially put me back together. And so I would consult with each of those doctors after, and they'd say, Kate, your bones, like you're plated here, here, and here, and you have like lumbar fixation hardware holding your pelvis together. So we have to wait until this heals in order to know that your bones are properly in place. So you cannot snowboard for a solid year, but Michelle, give yourself 2 years because you really want your bones to heal. You don't want to keep breaking these bones, and you need time to figure out how to snowboard with a prosthetic and to even grasp that you have a prosthetic leg now. Because often at the beginning, I would get out of bed and I'd start walking to the bathroom, not realizing that I no longer have that leg. And they realize this. So they're like, 2 years. We want you to wait 2 years before you jump on a snowboard. Give yourself time. So 8 months later, I was back on a snowboard, still walking with the cane. And obviously, like, I did listen to their advice. I took memory foam and I duct taped it around my body. I had these like bike shorts that had just layers and layers of memory foam. And I had these extra large pants and this jacket. And so my first time I went to COP, went to the bunny hill, and I was so frustrated because this was something I was once good at. And now I have this prosthetic leg that has Fox mountain bike shocks in it. I know nothing about it. I don't know where the PSI needs to be. It's still a new leg. I was actually the first female to ever use the Moto Knee. And there was no one around me that knew what they were doing either. So it was trial and error. And then as I slowly started figuring out the leg, it got better. And the third time out, I was with my sister at Rabbit Hill. And I had this suction socket at the time. It's held by suction. That is it. And I would sweat and I would lose volume and the socket would come off. Well, at one point, the socket went through these really large pants that I'm wearing and my leg was attached to my snowboard and it was going down the bunny hill at Rabbit Hill by itself with my leg attached to it. I traumatized a lot of people that day.
Oh my gosh. Okay. But yeah. Hey, go back to when you duct taped yourself with all the foam. Yeah. How did that first day go?
Like I fell quite a bit. I had a friend with me at the time and he wouldn't let go of my hands. And so, you know, he would, and then I would fall again. And it was definitely frustrating.
Okay. Yeah. So when you came home from that experience, how did you feel? Were you inspired, motivated, frustrated? What?
All of the above. There was a fire that was fueled in me. I knew it was going to be a long journey based on that experience, that I was going to have to spend a lot of time figuring out this leg. But it's really incredible because this whole experience has given me such a different perspective, as well as these overwhelming moments of gratitude. And, you know, I tell people that often, like as a parent, when you see your child walk for the first time or, you know, talk, or those milestones where you just feel so proud, I'm sure it was a very similar feeling for me because I was just so wholeheartedly proud of what I had accomplished, even despite going against all of my doctor's recommendations. I did it. I got back on my snowboard, you know, sooner than anyone thought I would. And I didn't break any, well, I did end up breaking my coccyx like a few months later. But aside from that, I figured it out.
Did you fess up to your doctors if this is what you were doing?
So I went out to Whistler to try out for the national team 1 year after my accident. And I had taken some pretty good falls. And at this point, I was trimming down the layers of the memory foam so I could wear like regular clothing. And I flew in to Calgary at midnight. And at 6 o'clock in the morning the next day, I went to get my pelvic lumbar fixation hardware removed. So these massive pins and bolts that were holding my pelvis together. I went in, and as they were giving me the gas, Brad Jacobs was my doctor. And he's like, Michelle, like, how's it going? And I was like, good. I tried out for the national team and then I passed out. So
Oh.
So he later comes to visit me in the you know, holding room where I'm recovering. And he's like, so you ended up breaking some of those pins that were holding. You got really lucky. Like, your pelvis is still in good shape, but I just want you to know. And so, yeah. But, you know, I have to say those doctors ended up being so incredibly supportive. And, you know, Dr. Powell was the one that amputated my leg. And it was one of the first text messages I got, you know, from his office when I landed in Sochi, was like, good luck and we're proud of you. So it was pretty amazing.
Okay. Did you make the team then when you tried out?
I did not. I was put on the prospect team. And, you know, like, Sochi was more of a fluke, given I had worked hard to be in the next spot, because unfortunately an athlete got injured and I was a late announcement to the Paralympic team. But they knew that in order to get me prepared for 2018, that I would go to 2014, or that they would want to send me. And so it just all worked out. Maybe some of it was fluke, because I definitely wasn't great, but I got there.
Oh my gosh. Hit the pause button on that journey for a second. Can you tell us more about your prosthetic and how it works and what, like you said, you had to learn so much about it.
Yeah. And it wasn't just my sports knee that I had to learn about. You know, I have at the time I had the Ottobock Genium, which was an $80,000 knee. So it's bionic knee, knows your gait pattern, swings with you, so you use less energy. I had to learn to figure that out. And then the sports knee had Fox shocks in it. So I was always playing. I always had my pump on me. I was always playing with the PSI to find the right angle. And truthfully, I didn't figure it out until a year after Sochi. I wasn't bending my knee and my toe turns at all. My back leg, which is your pivot, I wasn't bending it. So if you look at how I ride in Sochi and then how I ride or rode in Pyeongchang, mm-hmm. like, I was a completely different rider because I didn't know what I was doing. And then, you know, the season after, I had this amazing coach who knew mountain bike shocks, and he's like, let's figure this out. Next thing you know, I'm on every World Cup podium.
That, like, I'm trying to wrap my head around all this, and I'm sorry, it's just so much to digest. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out how you even put your leg into that prosthesis. And like, wasn't the pain astronomical?
The pain was really bad for the first year, especially the phantom pain, which is the feeling of the leg that you no longer have. For me, it's always been in the foot. I can still feel my foot. So, you know, I tried everything and it just didn't work, like acupuncture, everything. And the phantom pain, and it's still 10 years later, it's still bad. But I have a carbon fiber socket that was designed, it was casted. And so it's designed to accommodate the leg. And I have some, I don't want to say challenges, but I have a lot of residual skin. So for me, it is tough. I was told I would most likely never walk without a cane because I'm so high above the knee and have little femur. So, you know, I have learned to figure it out. I have many different designs of sockets. You know, I roll a neoprene liner over my leg, and that at the very bottom, there's a lanyard in my socket that attaches and it pulls me in and holds me into the socket. But over the years, Pyeongchang, my very first heat run to seed myself for the heats, my leg came off. So, you know, like, it's been challenging over the years, and having to do sports and be competitive with, you know, a residual limb or a condition that is changing.
Have you ever thought, I'd love to have a podcast just like this one? Well, I can help. My name is Matt Kundle, and everyone at my company, the Sound Off Podcast Network, had a hand in making this show. Whether it was about the sound, the discoverability, or that you're just enjoying the show, we are all about the detail. If you think you have a podcast in you, reach out to me via email, matt@soundoff.network. Or check out the website and become one of the great podcasts we work with at soundoff.network.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
It's been over a decade since your accident. Do you still have pain?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, at night, almost every night.
And how do you manage it?
Work out as much as I can throughout the day and try and tire my brain out so I fall asleep.
Oh, wow.
I exhaust myself. Yeah.
Extraordinary. Extraordinary. Okay. So you go to Sochi. You're now officially part of the Canadian Paralympic snowboarding national team.
Yeah.
Take us on the journey from there.
So the journey changed a lot after the 2014 game. So like I said, the next season we had a new coach and he had saw that I put a lot of work in and that even though my skill set was there, my confidence wasn't. So he would, you know, have the team go and do some laps and he would take me personally and do laps with me. And he'd be like, Kate, let's try this. Let's try that. And it started working. And then he would put me into these big courses that Able Body would ride and be like, Kate, let's see you get through this. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. That's how I die. No, like that's not happening. And he's like, no, like you got this. You have the skill set. Now have the confidence and do it. And so I would do it. I would get through it. And I'm like, wow, I am capable of doing this. And there was
How hard was it though?
It was hard.
It was more of a mind game, right?
It was a mind game for sure. And like so many people would see me ride outside of the course and be like, oh my gosh, you can't even tell that you're an amputee. But then the second you put me in this course with these corners and these big features, I would freeze up. I would hinder myself and put these barriers on myself. And, you know, there was days where I didn't care. And I just rode and I just loved to snowboard and I would be on the podium. And then there was days where I felt the pressure and I would miss the podium at world championships when, you know, I was that athlete going in with the opportunity to podium. And so I think that was the biggest thing for me was my mindset over the years. And trust me, the skill set, like we worked really hard on that. We worked hard to be great as a team and as individual athletes, but a lot of it went into that mindset and ensuring that was stable and strong.
Because the PTSD must have been overwhelming. Or did you have it? Because you said you couldn't remember anything.
I definitely still have PTSD. I do remember my out-of-body experience. I remember waking up, pulling the respirators out of my, or trying to pull them out. So there was a lot and there still is. And like, I don't even know what triggers it some days. I had panic attacks every day for a very, very long time. It was even like hearing someone's voice or the smell that would bring it on. And, you know, I crash in a corner and you put me into a border cross course with corners, massive berms, like there is a correlation there, right? And so,
absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that was really tough for me, those quick movements, but I loved it. I loved it so much that I just fought through it.
What was it? Do you know, have you given any thought? What is it that fuels you so much about it and helped you at that time?
Well, I think for me, it was knowing that I was given a second chance. And I like to think that now in my life, I'm an accountable person. And I told people that I was going to do something and I had to follow through with that because before my accident, I had a lot of failures. I was divorced at 24 and, you know, I had a business that wasn't as successful as I thought it was going to be and all of these different things. And so I was like, no, now is the time for me to just keep on doing it and to prove to myself that I was capable. Because a lot of people told me, just don't know if this is going to happen. You have so many things. Uh-huh. You didn't just lose your leg. You shattered your body and you struggle with mental health. So I don't know if this is going to happen. And that is motivating. Doubt is the biggest motivator. I was like, watch me. I'm going to prove you wrong.
So while you were doing all this, how did you pay the bills?
That was a tough one. And the reality of sport in Canada is that there is not a lot of money in it. I never got karting other than maybe 1 year. I got a dev card. So I had no money from the government coming in. So I worked full time. And when I really, like, in between 2014 and 2018, when I knew I had to focus, I quit my really fancy job right after Sochi. And I went back to real estate full time. And I'd be gone pretty much all winter, and I'd come back and I would work nonstop from like May to September to pay for not just my snowboard season, even though I had sponsors that paid for half of it, but you know, I'm paying for flights and accommodations and lane fees and entry fees and everything. But then I'm also paying for all of my expenses while I'm gone so that I can come home to a nice house and have a vehicle to drive and things like that, right? So it was a struggle for sure for those 4 years.
What was your support system like?
I didn't really have much of one. My family's never seen me compete. And, you know, it's
like never over the years.
Like they've seen me compete. Obviously, the both the Paralympics they watched online, but they've never seen me compete live. My sister, my younger sister, has been amazing. She did come out with me to watch a competition before I had made the national team, but they were busy. So I really did it alone in a lot of ways. I had some friends that were there that were great, but it's tough when you're gone as much as I was. And then when I'm home, all I'm doing is working, you know, you don't see people and people kind of forget about you and they stop inviting you to things because they just assume you're going to be gone. So it was really tough. My teammates became my family, and you know, we went through all of that together. So it was tough, but I'm really glad I had them and my awesome coaches.
Thank you for the powerful vulnerability you are demonstrating talking about this. And as like, I can feel the pain, I can see it. Where were mom and dad through all this? They weren't there to watch you cross that finish line?
They weren't, no. They, after 28 years, shortly after my accident, and I think it was right after the first Paralympics, maybe, they had split up. It was tough. It was tough for them to make it work. And I don't know. They weren't there. I'm not going to hold that against them, though, because I don't believe that's fair, and I don't want to put that guilt on anyone. So they just, it wasn't a priority, and it is what it is.
But it doesn't erase the fact that you wished they would have been there.
Oh, yeah.
Like, how did it feel? You'd cross the finish line, and who was there for you?
My teammates' families. But I didn't have, both Paralympics, I didn't have anybody there. So it was really tough for sure. It was definitely something that constantly went through my mind when I was at the top going for a medal. You know, the first games I understood, I was a late addition to the team, but the second games I was ranked third overall in the world going in. Like, that was my time to shine. And all I could think about was I have nobody at the bottom supporting me and cheering for me. And, you know, what if I medal? Like, I know that my teammates are going to be happy for me and my coaches and anyone who had been there, like all of my teammates' families, but who am I truly going to celebrate this with? So it was hard.
And you did medal countless times. Take us there to when you did and how your life changed.
You know, I did throughout the years. I had border crosses, you know, you do your timed runs and then it puts you into different seeds and then that's where, or heats, and that's where you race two at a time. And able body can be four to six at a time, but we were two at a time. And I had some really awesome races where it was like photo finish. I in Italy, I thought I had won my first gold medal and I could not understand Italian. And I went up the whole chairlift and I got to the top and nobody on my team could understand Italian either. So everyone's hugging and we're freaking out because I just beat the silver medalist in Sochi, and or so I thought. And then she had just like inches, just beat me. So it was, but regardless, like, you know, I proved to myself time and time again that I could make it happen and that I could push myself out of my comfort zone and put everything I had into those races that, you know, got me on that podium. I remember my first podium, it was in Big White in Canada, and we had World Cups all around the world. And I just remember, like, everyone was like cheering, and, you know, all these different countries and all my competitors. And it was a really, really neat feeling. It was like everything I went through in that moment was worth it. Like, there was no regrets. And if I could take back my accident, I wouldn't.
Wow. That's powerful.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
So was that the moment in your life where you really felt like I made it? You really made it.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. That was the moment where I was like, this has all been worth it. The struggles and the frustrations. It all makes sense.
As well, you were one of the most marketed athlete. Tell me what that was like.
Yeah. So going into the 2018 games, I was included in the Olympic campaign. I was the only Paralympian for Sport Tech Bell. I was the athlete they used for the Hilberg and Burke promotion. I had Tempur-Pedic. I had three commercials at the time. There was billboards everywhere. So it was a lot, you know. What do you mean by a lot? Well, though it was such an incredible honor to be the only Paralympian included in these campaigns, I remember, and I won't say what company it is or was, but I was at a dinner right before I left for the games, and the CEO of this massive company is like, "Oh, so like you're gonna medal." Because they're like breaking it down to numbers. Like, these are the odds that you're going to medal. So like, you kind of have to, right? And I'm like, well, no, like there's an opportunity for me not to medal. But yeah, they're like, I've worked hard. It is looking good. And it's like, well, we can't wait to see the medal when you come home. And that, to me, it was hard. It was really, really hard. Because I felt like there was expectation there. And I had done 20 speaking engagements that year where the hype was, look at me, look what I've been through, and I'm going into the games and I'm going to medal. And that wasn't healthy.
What did it do to you?
It crushed me very, very much so. I finished fourth and fifth. I left before closing ceremonies. I stopped talking to everybody. I didn't work for 7 months because I couldn't get out of bed. It put me into the darkest place in my life where it made more sense for me not to be on this earth than to be on this earth because it was really tough.
Michelle, that's heavy. That's like,
yeah.
I mean, suicidal thoughts.
Yeah. Every day, multiple times a day, like, made videos, been hospitalized, you know, I said my goodbyes, I was ready to go. And the one day where I got my absolute closest, I had texted a friend that morning and I wasn't replying. And so he called me and he kept calling me over and over and over again. And finally I picked up and I was hysterical. And he's like, you need to get in your vehicle and you need to drive to come see me right now. And I was seconds away from, you know, not being here. And so it was really hard. And I talked about it to my boyfriend at the time and to my best friend. And I would say, I've lived a good life. Like, just know that if I do this when I do this, that I loved you guys, but I just can't live with this kind of pain anymore. And they would cry and they would say, please don't do it. And I'm like, we need to be at peace with this. I'm at peace with this. And I would try and convince them this was the best thing for me. It was like, I had a time frame in my mind. I was going to say my goodbyes. I was going to do whatever I had to do and it was going to happen.
And it didn't happen.
It didn't happen. No.
What stopped you?
Right after the Paralympics, I went to the SPCA and I brought home this dog. Her name was Karma and I named her Lenny. And Lenny had a really rough life before I brought her home. She was badly abused. And Lenny is the most loving, incredible dog ever. And I'm not kidding you. She has saved my life because she knew something wasn't right. And she would jump on the bed and put her head to my chest and just do whatever she could to save me. And she was a huge part of it. But also just knowing that there was still that fight. There was that little bit of fight that I, even though I wanted to ignore it so bad and just be at peace with my decision, I couldn't. Every time it's like, no, like, Michelle, what's going to happen if you do this to the people that you love, mm-hmm. to everything that you've worked so hard for, to your legacy? Like, there's so much more that you can create if you just keep fighting. And I started seeing a counselor and I started telling people about it. And to be honest, I lost a lot of friends when I started talking about it.
You did?
I did.
Before talking about mental health issues became more, I'm going to say, mainstream, because we have progressed so much as a society. We have a long way to go, but now people more and more are coming forward and we're doing all we can to erase the stigma. But this was before this all began, right?
I don't know. This is probably 2 years ago. So,
oh gosh, then it's not at all.
No. So it's still, unfortunately, there is still a stigma, especially when it comes to sports. Maybe we don't talk about it as much as we should, and head injuries will lead to mental health issues. So it was tough. Like, people didn't want to have the conversation. Like, hey, I have suicidal thoughts. I am on the edge right now. I am struggling. It'd be 50-50. I'd have that conversation and they'd be like, okay, like, how can I help? And then the other ones would be like, well, I don't know what to say. This isn't something I've struggled with. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to help you. And they would be uncomfortable with the situation and they would leave. And I struggled with that. And that was part of the reason that it became such a daily thought. It's like, people can walk away from me so easy knowing that I'm struggling. Like, what does this say about me? Like, what did I do for people to so quickly leave when I need them the most? And I internalized that, and it was tough. It was really hard, but, you know, in the end, I got the help I needed. I tapped into my resources and, you know, I don't even think about it anymore. It's very, very rare I think about it.
Okay. First of all, you do know that when you said, what does this say about me? It says nothing about you and everything about them.
Yeah. I know that now.
It's nothing to do with you. It's with them.
Yep.
And their inability to hold space for someone who is struggling. And it is, I will say this, it's when someone tells you that, to be in that position is challenging. Of course, not nearly as challenging as the person who's going through it. So I want to ask you this question. Now that you've lived through it, you're through the other side, you're on the path. Mm-hmm. How can people help someone like you in that circumstance?
I didn't need the sympathy. I didn't need that. I really just needed someone to call me and be my friend and say, let's go for a bike ride, or let's go snowboarding, or let's go do something. And it seemed like in that time, people could feel my energy and it wasn't good and they didn't want to be around me. And so I wasn't getting those calls, you know, people weren't reaching out, and it was just so tough. It really was. And I think that if, you know, from the outside looking in, if anybody can do anything, it's just be there, just listen, find ways to, I don't want to say distract the person, but show them what they have to offer the world and like what they'll be missing out on. Right. Because that for me, like, I started snowmobiling and I was like, I'm going to miss out on these amazing powder days where I can venture to these places that, you know, I didn't think a snowmobile would ever take me. It's just creating those opportunities, those fun opportunities for people to enjoy life, whether it be laughing or adventuring or whatever it is.
Such powerful advice. I appreciate you addressing that question, because so many people are struggling in this COVID world. And oftentimes you're not sure how to show up. I think the bottom line is what you said, just show up. show up and whatever that looks like. It may be a walk, it may be hanging out, because oftentimes the person you're showing up for really doesn't know what they need either. Mm. So just to give that company and extend that friendship, that would have made all the difference for you, wouldn't it have?
Oh yeah. I still wanted to go out and have fun, and I just didn't really have those people in my corner at the time. And I think for me, that was the hardest, because, you know, you feel isolated, and especially now more than ever, there's that feeling of isolation. So even like a FaceTime call or just seeing that people cared would have went a long way. And there was still people that cared, but I think they didn't know how to approach it.
Right. I want to talk about, there's a portion we didn't address when you came home and you said you immediately went to a very dark place. You didn't meddle. What happened after you didn't meddle?
So after I came home from the games, obviously I came home early, and I had a boyfriend at the time who lived on the island, and he had this beautiful cabin on the lake. So I went out there and again, didn't really get out of bed, spent a lot of my time just sitting on his deck. And then he's like, let's do a Tofino trip. So I'm on the beach in Tofino after a frustrating day of learning how to surf in very cold weather. It was May. Yeah, so cold. Oh. And I get a call from, actually, I think it was a text from my brother saying, hey, have you talked to dad recently? Because he has something to tell you. I'm like, what's going on? And my brother's like, I can't tell you. It is not for me to tell. So I'm thinking something is wrong with my dad. So I call him. He doesn't pick up. I call my little sister and she's like, nope, don't know anything, even though she did. But she, again, everybody knew, but they weren't going to tell me because it was for my dad to tell me. So finally I get him on the phone, and he starts off the conversation with, just know that I love you and you'll always be my daughter, but I'm not your biological father.
Oh,
so I'm like, you know, at this point I had already decided to retire. I had too many head injuries, and I knew that part of my life was over, and I had no idea what my life was going to look like, where I was going to go. And then all of a sudden that happens. And so I had this huge identity crisis. I had no idea who I was, because my whole life, those 7 years have revolved around being a Paralympian. And now that was gone. And all of a sudden my maiden name is Vrolik. Like, I'm no longer a Vrolik and my dad's daughter. Right. So it was tough.
And all the other, your siblings?
It was, you know, obviously it was a shock to them too, but yeah, they were actually really amazing about it and supportive, and it was good.
But they were children of your father.
So my two brothers came from another marriage, and so I thought they were half my whole life. And then all of a sudden they're no longer blood, which they'll always be my brothers, right? But it does change something for sure. And then, you know, this is the second time it had happened. My mom actually told my older sister that her dad had drowned, and that wasn't the case. So it was the second time that had happened in my family that it was held back.
Oh, Michelle. This is so heavy. This is you know, that is so much to have on your plate. And then also all your sponsors who had been helping pay the bill, what happened there?
That changed overnight. And
so wait, the second you didn't meddle, they left?
I don't want to say they necessarily left. Like, Sportjack was really good and they still got me involved in events and stuff, but no one really reached out to say, hey, we're proud of you for your finish. You know, I did finish the top in my country, the top placement in my country, but it was really tough.
How do you process that?
I don't know. And I think that it'd be really nice if companies had a bit more awareness. Can't really give the details, but there is a change being made going into not the summer games, but the next winter games with a major sponsor. And they had asked us feedback, like, what can we do differently? And I said, you support your athletes after they're done, whether they medal or not, you support them. You tell them you're proud, because I didn't really hear that from anyone. And so it was really hard. And then all of a sudden now I don't have those sponsorship dollars coming, which was my decision too, right? But I wasn't competing anymore. It was like overnight, everything went away. I became irrelevant in my mind. I just became irrelevant.
Why did you choose to retire?
I was just dealing with mental health, those issues, and I'd hit my head one too many times, and I couldn't do it anymore. I was really starting to forget everything. My short-term memory was worse than a goldfish. It was really tough. And I knew that at my age, I think I was 33 at the time, that I had to give the opportunity to someone else to take that place. And, Sandrine, one of my former teammates, who's still a very close friend of mine, I knew that she was going, like, she was hungry. She's, going to go for that medal, and she's still working at it, and she's been on a lot of podiums. And so it was time to sit back and be the support system for once.
Incredible. Were you the one that helped precipitate these changes that are coming to sport, so that it's not just about the medal, and that organizations have to show up for athletes, even if they don't medal? I mean, the amount of tsunamis that you persevered through is astounding. Was it you behind that?
I wouldn't necessarily say it was me. There was a documentary that was put together, I think it was by HBO, and they talk about, I forget what it's called, but it's got some gold medalists on there, and they talk about the Olympic blues, even after you medal, what that looks like after, right? Because you work 4 years, you put 4 years into nothing else. That is it. Like, you live and you breathe your sport and your results. So what happens when that's over? Where does that hype go, right? It is so hard. And then you finish. I have talked to Justin and Tristan that finished fourth, and Sam Edney, and these athletes that were like, they were there, they were going for fourth, and they're like, Michelle, it takes so long. And luckily, like, they worked really hard going into the next games, and they both medaled in the next games. But it was those 4 years in between the games that were like, I couldn't even talk about it because it was so tough. Yeah.
Incredibly challenging last 2 years for you. Take us to where you are today, where your heart and your mind is at, and how you're coping.
Yeah, so I've worked really hard the last year, especially to put myself first and to figure out who I am, because that's changed. After the games, I stopped speaking. I didn't feel like I had a story, and I moved to the Okanagan. Probably it was a year after the games, and I was offered this incredible job that at the time I was like, this is the direction I want to go, and has now turned into my absolute dream job. But I'm able to do for other people what someone once did for me, and that's, quality of life, give mobility back as a medical equipment rep. So I help get people into wheelchairs and rehab equipment. And my main focus now is pediatric. So, like, little tiny wheelchairs are so adorable, and like gait trainers, and, parents get to see their kids walk for the first time, and standers. And it's just so amazing and rewarding, and has, I don't want to say it defines me, but it's become such a big purpose now, because I was once the patient and the client, and now I'm the rep. And so it's truly incredible. I'm still, I'm snowmobiling a lot. I'm wake surfing. Obviously COVID has changed a lot of what that looks like, but I'm enjoying life. I'm happy. I am so grateful to wake up every day. And I think that the people around me that stuck it through with me are able to see that big changes have happened in my life in the last year.
I'm so happy to hear you say that. It sounds as though you've stepped into your purpose in this new line of work for you.
Yeah, I really have.
In addition to that, I want you to really reconsider your decision to step off the speaking circuit, because I'm so honored that you are sharing to such a degree, because you're going to touch countless lives with your story and the power that is associated with it. And I know when we initially talked about doing the podcast, you weren't sure, right?
Yeah.
And why is that?
Because I felt like, you know, and we talked about the book and what that looks like. And I didn't feel like I had an ending, like I had that big bang ending, right? But I see now what I'm doing, and even just overcoming the mental health aspect of it is, you know, that.
Is that puppy?
Oh, sorry. That's, yeah. You know, that's my ending. Like, I don't need that big bang ending.
You don't.
You know, I got through it. I'm here. Like, that's it. I'm here. That's my ending.
Well, and that's what I was going to say is that, you know, you said the book, you've been wanting to write a book for a long time. Now I'm going to challenge you with everybody listening to put pen to paper, to start writing, because it goes without saying that your story is remarkable. Everything you've went through, but more importantly, everything you have persevered through and continued on, and you didn't give up no matter what. And that big ending, that is your ending, is that you have been through some of the toughest times in your life, and through it all, you found your purpose and you're here and you're sharing your story. And damn it, girl, you better continue to do that, because the world needs more of Michelle Salt.
Thank you. Thank you.
What a gift. What a gift to talk to you. Before I say thank you, I want to know what else is on Michelle Salt's hopes and dreams list.
Well, I've been looking at, you know, having a baby on my own through surrogate, because I can't carry a baby. So, yeah, you know, I
carry a baby as a result of the accident.
Yes, I cannot. So I would have to use a surrogate, but my sister doesn't know this yet. Maybe I am hoping that she really loves being pregnant. She's done having kids, but yeah, I'm looking at surrogacy and obviously using a donor and just being a single mom, because I'm, you know, busy living my life and I haven't met someone special just yet. So there's that, and obviously getting back to traveling, and who knows, there's always something that comes up and I'm like, oh, I got to advocate for that. You know, I got to.
Oh my goodness. You have so much more living to do, so much. And just do me a favor and take the just out of it. Just being a mom, it's never just.
Yeah, for sure.
I hope with everything in my heart and in my soul that you become a mom one day. I know that you would be a brilliant mother. You would never give up no matter what. And get writing that book. Get back on that speaking tour. Like I said, you have one of the most incredible stories to share. I'm humbled at the way that you trusted me with the vulnerability that you demonstrated. And for those people wanting to book you for speaking engagements, where do they find Michelle Salt?
So I do have a website. It's michellesalt.com, or even just through my Facebook page, my athlete page.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the way that you stepped into the inner circle, the empowerment, the inspiration. You are a gift.
Thank you.
I want to end today by extending my gratitude to you for listening. You know, time is our most precious commodity. We don't have enough of it most days. So I am so grateful that you shared some of your precious time with me. Thank you so much. For show notes and links to our guests and everything we talked about today, you can head to my website, carriedoll.co. That is CarrieDoll.co. Once you're there, you can find links to Instagram and Facebook. You can sign up for my newsletters and get information on my public speaking courses. I want to empower women and people everywhere to use their voice, to invest in themselves, and to be comfortable anytime, anywhere, giving a powerful, unforgettable speech. Come with me. Join the movement of the inner circle. Let's go on this journey together.
A production of the Sound Off Media Company.
I'm Andrea Askowitz.
And I'm Allison Langer.
And we are the host of Writing Class Radio, a podcast, but we are so much more. We have writing classes. So if you are looking for live online classes where you can join a community, write to a prompt, get feedback, and get better, check out all our classes at writingclassradio.com and listen to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts and at writingclassradio.com.